friends, and welcome back to another edition of Conservation Stories. This is your host, Tillery Timmons Sims, and I am excited today to be visiting with Ethan Triplett. So I have a couple of things I want to talk to Ethan about, so we're going to have to record two podcasts to get all that in. But today, I want to talk to him about sorghum and whole grains and all the health things and all the science, because he is a scientist. And Ethan, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
I would love for you to give us a little bit of background. I know that you, you're here in Lubbock working for the sorghum board. Tell us a little bit about your family and your education and how you got to working with sorghum.
Yeah, absolutely. So sorghum's kind of been a passion project of mine since I started as a freshman in college. In fact, I was originally studying to be a wildlife biologist, and I stepped out of my class on one of those first introductory classes, and I got pulled off to the side by a ag professor, and I guess they were in the business of recruiting from other disciplines and told me, hey, if you come over and work for the agricultural department and you work as a plant science, as a kind of a research technician, we'll pay for your schooling. And I said, okay, sure. So I followed the funding and landed in the program of Dr. Bonnie Pendleton, just an exceptional sorghum entomologist, studied underneath her from bachelor's and master's, got the bug. Literally studied sorghum aphids for from 2015 all the way through my doctoral program, and then really just fell in love with the crop and how versatile it is, its historical significance, the wide reaching applications in far of like different cultures. I got to meet a lot of people from all around the world that use it in different ways, and so that kind of led me to really start seeking out what does it look like in my everyday life. And that's where the mill kind of was born. I saw sorghum as a frontier crop. It's not widely recognized as a human food in the United States, and so wanted to provide something unique. Had a lot of friends in the industry, and so here we are. And anyways, I was branded enough with sorghum that the sorghum guys over at National Sorghum Producers picked me up, and we're all fanatics. So
yes,
here we are.
Yes. Well, I like to say that sorghum went from zero to the darling of the commodity world. It's like, to me, of course, I think a whole lot of that has to do with the leadership over there, which is phenomenal. Someday I'll have to get some of those, in particular, Tim Lust. I'd love to have him on. He's just a great leader. And I've been really, really impressed at how they've taken that like commodity that nobody could agree on the name even, you know, and created something, that really is at the forefront, I think, of sustainability when you look at commodity crops. And I mean, when I say, I don't even like the word sustainability, because I don't even really know why we want to sustain what we have. So maybe stewardship, you know, we like that word better. So you have a mill, and this is something that may be foreign to a lot of people. I personally grew up with a mother who ground wheat and made bread for us, and we thought she was trying to kill us. And in an effort to get us to eat such bread that was brown, she would shape her, make little buns like turtles, and they had little feet and a little head. And then she would slice the shell and make our sandwich in that. You know, of course, all my friends at school thought that was just amazing. And we just tried to, you know, not gag, because we just thought it was terrible. But eventually it did take root. And my goodness, there's nothing better than fresh ground wheat berries and made into things like cinnamon rolls. They're so good. And so, but I bet a lot of people don't really even know that it's a thing, you know, like that you can get something that's brownish from the grocery store. So talk a little bit about the process, like what we're getting from the store that's white. What is it? What is that going through? I mean, whatever grain it is, but particularly wheat? What is the process it's going through that is making it white and shelf stable?
For sure. Yeah, great question. So I'll kind of speak on the differences between what I do as a stone miller and then just kind of like an industrial mill. And
yes,
so
great.
Industrial roller mill, pretty much what it will do is as the grain comes through, it will strip out the bran and the germ, and all they're after is the endosperm. And that endosperm is going to be what is bright white flour carbohydrates. All of the majority of your vitamins and minerals and healthy fats are going to be found within the bran and the germ. And so once that's removed and the endosperm remains, you're left with pretty much a structural ingredient. And why do I call it structural ingredient? Well, it's because that the gluten proteins, which unravel and allow bread to rise and hold its shape, that's really the benefit and the good of bright white shelf stable flour. You know, there's other benefits and there's other processes that would happen. Like for instance, like they'll condition the wheat, they'll bleach the wheat in some instances to get it even whiter using ascorbic acid or whatever sort of methodology they're using in order to kind of get that bright white flour shelf stable. But truthfully, what it comes down to it is the mechanics of milling is inherently different. Whereas a stone mill, and what I do is it kind of comprehensive. So I cannot remove bran from the germ or from the endosperm just simply because the stones, as they're rotating, just gently peel and incorporate all three of those components together. Even if I were to sift the flour, yes, a portion of those bigger pieces of bran will be removed, but there is still microscopic pieces within the same size range of an endosperm flour within my product. So those are the major differences. And you mentioned like the brown loaf, the stone milled flour or fresh milled flour kind of gets a bad rap for like being dense and heavy and difficult to work with. It's a little bit of a learning curve because of that. I mean, if you're trying to compare it to something that you can purchase at the store, it's a little more thirsty. It doesn't necessarily behave as similar. But anyways, the major difference is that we're retaining flavor and nutrition. Whereas a store-bought flour, it is retaining structure. That's really what they're after. They're after repeated, replicable results across the country. And we are kind of leaning on the idea of a single source product that behaves differently from season to season. And I think that's beautiful.
That's interesting. Behaves differently from season to season. Explain that.
Absolutely. So pretty much any plant, doesn't have to be wine or coffee.
That's the two I was thinking about. I was like, wait a minute, this sounds like wine.
Yeah. It takes on a different characteristics, different traits as dependent upon what's happening in the growing
season.
So just like wine, that's exactly
right.
Did
not know this. I learned something every time.
Yeah, just like wine. And so there's like literature out there that would suggest that, you know, particular areas in Georgia produce wheat that has a cocoa type of aftertaste, or a wheat that's produced under irrigation or non-irrigated will of course alter protein contents, but more importantly alter those secondary metabolites that we lean on for flavor development. As the plant is interacting with its environment, that physiological change that's happening in the plant, it's going to be altering its chemistry based off of what it can produce readily or what it needs to produce, right? So if you're thinking about things that are like, I don't know, flavonoids or something, a secondary metabolite that's used in multiple different instances, whether it might be antioxidant capacity for the plant to defend itself against disease, or something that it sifts itself and cooling it down, no matter what, those metabolites also lend a hand to how we enjoy that plant. The best one to bring across kind of point across the plant kingdom would be capsaicin, right?
Okay, yes.
So different seasons.
Yes. Okay.
different seasons produce different degrees of a spice level in a pepper. A home gardener will tell you that if you water that pepper, or if you don't beat your tomatoes with a broom, that it doesn't produce a lot, or they're not as sweet. So we intuitively know, well, the same is true for commodities. We just are producing them at scale and blending them so well that we don't know that it's the same.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're trying to make everything taste the same, like, so that you know what you're getting every time. So this is just really fascinating to me, because I think about, I know, you know, when my mother was trying to source wheat, you know, in the 80s, we'd want to get like hard, you know, wheat from, you know, somewhere like in Montana. And, but we did a couple of times, you know, we grew some triticale, and we did use that from time to time, and things, you know, that were closer by. And, I do remember that like it tasted different, you know, based on, you know, some of the things like where it came from, and it functioned different. I could say like that. It just, you know, your bread might be different as far as the texture goes and how you could work with it and that kind of thing. So when you're milling from, like, I don't know, like, I feel like I'm asking somebody that's like a winemaker. So are you like, I'm milling this sorghum from, this is vintage 2024, yeah, and it has notes of coconut and blueberry, and I mean, is your palate that like sophisticated that you can taste the difference in different seasons, in different years?
What a great question. I would say my wife's palate is. Wow. I would say mine is. I can pick up differences between varieties, but between seasons, mm-hmm, you know, unless I'd have them right in front of me, it would be difficult to kind of understand and pick up that nuance. Mm-hmm. But here's the reality: is that what I see as a stone miller, and this is where it's a blend of art and science, right? So from the science perspective, we can back it. We know that differences in season and production types alter the chemistry of the plant in order to produce a different product. As an art form now, it's translating that into, well, what does that mean for the culinary world? And you're right. It's like a winemaker. Yes, it's like a specialty coffee roaster.
Yes.
It's a decommoditization of a commodity.
Yes, yes. I just think that, you know, I was in Brussels and Poland earlier this year, and it's such a different experience to eat there. It's completely different. And I think about what we've lost. You know, food for us is like, we are all 100% about efficiency in the United States. And oh my goodness, we've lost so much. Like, we've lost so much in the race to be efficient.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. In fact, if there's ever an opportunity and you want to wrestle with that concept of efficiency over, well, really quality, if you want to go distill it that down to that level, there's a great book, In Defense of Food, by Michael Pollan, talking about our cultural relationship with a meal. What does it mean to sit down at a dinner table and enjoy a meal? Is it efficient, something that you time slot into your schedule, or is it an opportunity to engage in conversation? And that type of, he kind of wraps himself around the argument, and I'm distilling the book, it's way, way, way more complex than this, but wraps around that argument to say that cultures that have a relationship with food, that food is more significant than calories, that by definition, that type of food will be slow food because it goes at the pace of culture. And the pace of culture means we are going to reminisce over something. We're going to enjoy a glass of wine with one another. We're going to enjoy breaking bread. And that bread means significant to me. It's significant to my family. So we should put the best ingredients into it. Whereas efficiency removes and disconnects our reality. We no longer have a culture with what we are eating. We have no memory of it, right? We might, in some instances, we might crack open that dusty cookbook and say, I'm going to make my grandmother's pasta recipe, and I'm going to buy every single best ingredient in the world and spend a Saturday making it. But that's the exception and not the rule. The culture in connection with that is such a once we step into that type of relationship where we look at food as significant, as something that is not putting at the bottom of our basis of counting calories, which I think is just deconstructing food to its raw basis points. It's ridiculous. And we start to put on more of an emphasis on what does this mean? Am I providing a nutritional meal for my family? That's what this all started for me, was providing nutritional meals for my family. And then all of a sudden, it started becoming talking points at the dinner table. Well, this wheat was produced by this farmer and produced in this way. And then all of a sudden, it started to become fun. It was like opening up a bottle of wine or brewing a lot of geisha coffee, right? It was a culture moment. And so that's kind of where it all kind of blends in, and our connection with efficiency is no longer, it's no longer a part of the conversation. If it takes 60 minutes to brew, to mill 50 pounds, then it takes 60 minutes to mill 50 pounds. So
exactly.
Anyways.
Out here on the Texas Plains, water is everything, and there's a resource that's as vital as it is fragile, our Playa Lakes. These lakes are nature's reservoir, catching rainwater to recharge our aquifer and provide lifelines for wildlife. But now they need our help. In collaboration with the Texas Playa Lakes Conservation Initiative and the Cargill Global Water Challenge, Sarah has started the Our Legacy is Tomorrow's Water Initiative to inspire and work with landowners to restore and protect our Playa Lakes. Each playa we save helps secure a sustainable water future for the generations that will be coming after us. Whether it's improving soil health, restoring habitats, or recharging groundwater, we are committed to making a difference. Together, we can build a legacy that we can all be proud of. To learn how you can join in, visit the Playa Lakes Restoration Initiative page on the SARA website. Let's keep Texas water flowing strong for the future. Visit sara-conservation.com. I mean, I feel like we have just, it is just easier to say this is good and this is bad. So industrial, like we fed the world. We're feeding the world. So we don't need locally sourced food. Or locally sourced food is fundamentally better for you. We don't need industrial ag. You know, and so, I mean, I'm kind of the person who's like, we do not have to, we can say two opposite things are true at the same time.
It can happen.
It can happen. You know, I can't remember who we had on. We were talking about energy waste in a couple of podcasts ago, and I really liked what Gabriel Rio was saying, because I feel like he found the middle, and I'm like, that's my favorite place, is the middle. And I grew up being told that that's where, you know, yellow stripes and dead skunks were, was in the middle, you know? But I'm like, you know what? That is actually the hardest place to get to. And usually that's where you're going to find the truth. It's somewhere in the middle. But you know what it takes is time. And I think you can probably like speak to this a little bit of like how, you know, not only like what we've done to our wheat, we're taking out what's good, and they are putting those things back in. I mean, you know, they do add vitamins and they add put fluoride, I think, in some cases. I mean, some of the things they're taking out, they're putting back in.
Yeah.
But it's almost like it's such a view kind of what our culture is, in that we've split ourselves apart in order to be efficient. And so our body is one piece, and our mental health is one piece, and like our spiritual part is one piece, but really it's all one thing, you know? And it feels like in order to be efficient, we split these things apart, And instead of thinking about that they are all one thing, and we can't really, if you go back and add it later, it's just not the same. And I think, you know, a while ago you said, and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about this, the fat that is in wheat, that it takes out the fat in wheat. And I would like to say, this is the first time I've ever heard about fat being in wheat. Like, what kind of fat is in wheat? And like, is it like, are you, what is that?
For sure. Yeah. So, I mean, the fat content in wheat is pretty insignificant, being only around, you know, a couple of grams of total lipids. That fat, it produces, you know, if we're going to follow the old adage of if fat follows flavor, it's the lipid stores in the plant. I can speak to the physiology.
Yes, that's
we'll put it this way. Yeah. I can't speak to the nutritionist, because I'm not a nutritionist, and I will not pretend to own one. But fat is produced as a store for the plant. It's what allows for the plant to access carbohydrates. Another storage, or as far as the endosperm is concerned, but the fat is going to be another. And so whenever we're retaining that, one, we're shortening shelf life because that fat can go rancid. However, it's also incorporating the full extent of the flavor, because that fat follows flavor, right? Mm-hmm. And so that whole grains have insignificant, mind you. It's not like we're talking about a stick of butter.
Right.
We're talking grams here.
Sure.
But nonetheless, we have an opportunity to where it is a nutrition, or a degree of nutrition, that is, that by method of stone milling, or by method of milling that incorporates and retains 100% of the grain, we keep. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the crux of the matter is that you're right. You mentioned the removal of the bran and the germ, where the germ's going to be where the majority of the fat is, where that little the little basically plantlet, if you will, being removed, and then the plant, knowing that it just now has a structural ingredient that needs to be somewhat nutritional, they'll bring in to and reincorporate back what they've taken away in a form of additives, right? They'll enrich the flour in some cases. That is negated in this process. And that's really just where it comes down into play.
So we've talked a lot. I mean, I keep going back to wheat because that's what I think of when I think of bread. But I want you to talk to me about sorghum, because I know I'm good friends with, you probably know Brandon and Hannah Lips. I don't know if you know Brandon and Hannah, but they, Hannah worked for sorghum growers for a while, and they've been part of getting sorghum approved to go into school lunches. I know nothing about other than what I have seen them share. Tell us about sorghum. What do we look for? Like, if we decide we want to eat it, like, what do we look for? And why sorghum? Why should we eat it?
So,
and also, before I forget, the name, because, okay, everywhere else in the world, don't they call sorghum, they call corn maize, and what do they call sorghum in other grain sorghum in other parts of the world?
They'll get its nickname of Milo.
Milo, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or if you're anywhere in international,
yes,
they might call it jawar, which is just the Indian name for it.
Okay.
You'll also, I mean, there, it goes by many names.
Many names.
Milo is kind of a,
that's what I grew up calling it.
Old.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's an old expression. Lots of producers will just claim that they'll plant a field of Milo. And mm-hmm. it's a kind of an idiom that trades back and forth, right? It's just another name. Nonetheless, why sorghum? Great question. Well, sorghum, first and foremost, flavor is exceptional. Very lightly sweet, a little bit nutty, has a a really well-rounded profile that plays well with pretty much any Southern meal that you could think of. In fact, my house, we regularly make sorghum bread, which is essentially following any old cornbread recipe and substituting corn flour for sorghum flour.
Okay.
And it performs exactly the same.
Okay.
And the flavor is not that you're looking for that old time homey corn richness. It's not going to give you that because it's something in of itself, right?
Right.
It's going to give you this nutty, very sweet, very approachable and mild. And when I say approachable, the reason why I use that word is because approachable, letting you know that it's not something so foreign that the Southern American palate doesn't know what to do with it.
Interesting.
And so it tastes and feels like a memory.
Oh my goodness.
Right?
Like it connects to the DNA. It's still there. It's still in our DNA. Yeah. Our body remembers eating it.
So that being said, that's the approachable component. But as far as the nutritional component is the sorghum checkoff has incredible literature around this subject. If you wanted to do a deep dive, you could. It's an excellent source of protein. It's an excellent source. It has 12 essential nutrients, including high in fiber, iron, and zinc. It has, as far as like the essential source of nutrients, we're talking things like thiamine, riboflavin, copper, iron, magnesium. These like really wonderful, like just a part of a conversation the other day that we were discussing and the incorporating sorghum into a diet. And somebody said, oh, this is like it's like a multivitamin, right?
Oh,
it kind of is in a way, right?
Yes.
And so incorporating this into your diet really lets you pick up some of those nutrients that were lost through efficiency back into your kind of day-to-day consumption. And it's not just consumed as flour. I'm a miller. I'm going to grind things into flour because that's just what I do. But it's also, you can eat it as a whole grain and cook it similar to rice. You can crack it and cook it like polenta. It's really well-versed and versatile. And so that is kind of the reasons why we would incorporate it into our diet. From a nutritional standpoint, like I said, deep dive in the sorghum checkoff. From a flavor standpoint, I can state that it is an incredible addition to what we would normally reach for like a flatbread, like blending
pizza,
it
pizza at crust?
20%.
Pizza crust.
Pizza crust. Mm. Exactly. I mean, pizza crust is gonna. So there's gonna be a little bit of a caveat here, right? Sorghum is naturally gluten-free, so it has no structural protein that holds itself together.
Yes, okay.
And so if you're going to be making something like a pizza crust and you want it to be reminiscent of a pizza crust, you're going to have to do some tweaks to it. And whether that might be adding in, you know, xanthan gum or some sort of binder to it, if you wanted to stay gluten-free, great. What I normally do is blended at 20% with a wheat.
Okay.
And you capture that flavor, but you still retain the structural integrity from the wheat as it's giving its gluten to hold things together. So, but that's kind of the 10,000 foot view of sorghum and sorghum nutrition.
Oh my goodness. This has been really interesting. I knew it would be. Okay. So before we close up, I would like for you to tell us about Revival Meal. That's the name of your meal. Let's talk. One question that I have about Stone Meal, and this is not personally my question. I'm asking this on behalf of other people who I've heard ask this question. But do you get rocks in your food if you Stone Meal something?
Great question. So no. If my stone is breaking apart and you're getting a rock in your flour, I've got a way bigger problem, and you've got to let me know that ASAP. So, I mean, here's the reality, right? I'm bringing those stones to the degree where they're going to get within, you know, millimeters, if not even smaller, micrometers, if I'm good, before touching.
Before they touch. Mm-hmm.
And wow. The touching, if they do touch, it's incredibly bad for my equipment and I need to recalibrate everything. Mm. So, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. To speak to even further, you know, having a minute amount of silica or mm-hmm. ash in your flour,
I've heard this,
is really not a much of a problem from mm-hmm. as far as like mm-hmm. nutritional components.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so my stones were quarried out of Vermont, and they were etched by that millwright New American Stone Mills.
Okay.
And that quarry or that stone, it's predominantly silica. It's just sand. Silica, it's a limestone, but if you grind it into powder, it's okay. Predominantly just silica.
Silica, okay.
So that being said, we've got really a it's not stones that you're eating, but rather mm-hmm. a natural byproduct of the grain.
It's a mineral.
It's a mineral. Yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a mineral that's grinding mm-hmm. together, and it's shaving off just minute mm-hmm. pieces mm-hmm. At a time. Mm-hmm. Put it in perspective. If you've ever had tortillas mm-hmm. that were nixtamalized mm-hmm. and ground by stone, mm-hmm. the same story is there. It's a volcanic mm-hmm. stone from Mexico. I mean, mm-hmm. or if you've ever had anything that's been like a molcajete and producing some sort of pounded guacamole or mm-hmm. salsa mm-hmm. out of mm-hmm. a volcanic okay. stone bowl.
Yes.
We have a connection as humans with cooking with earthenware and stones for a very long time, and it has not affected us yet. We'll put it
yes,
that way.
Right.
It's not affecting us.
Yes.
It's still allowing for us for health to benefits to come into play. And it's not that we have a broken relationship with it. It's just that's an older method of processing food.
Okay. So Revival Meal, I love the name, in Lubbock. Where if people are like, I want to make some focaccia bread with sorghum, or I want to make some faux cornbread with this, where do we find it? Where can we get it?
For sure. Yeah. So as of right now, we don't have a brick and mortar location. That's something that we are working on. As of right now, the easiest way to get access to us is order online, revivalmeal.com. Okay. It allows you to, we mail on Tuesdays and Thursdays and deliver to Nashville Cafe as our pickup location downtown.
Okay.
That is our kind of a full ecosystem.
Okay.
And other than that, we're at pop-ups and farmers markets.
Let's just say you milled this on Thursday. I picked it up on Saturday morning at the farmer's market. Do I need to put it in the refrigerator? Do I need to freeze it? What do I do?
I have a good, better, best program to help my customers out. Good is airtight. Put it in an airtight container. Better, airtight, and cool. So you'll if you're popping in the fridge, it's gonna actually, if it's not airtight, it could lead to humidity problems. But if you're gonna have a spot in your cupboard that is cool, pop it there, right? Best, if you're doing long term, is vacuum seal it, pop it in the freezer.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Oh my goodness, this has been so interesting. And it's been very motivational for me just to think about we're too busy to take care of ourselves. And man, it's worth it, you know? And I mean, I am getting of the age where I have noticed I do not bounce back as quickly as I once did. And like, it's getting a little, I guess the awareness of approaching health issues is more forefront in my mind. And so when I think about this, one thing I will say, I do know, because I grew up, my mom, like I said, but then I did the same thing for my kids. And it's not hard. It's not hard to do. And even, you know, starting from scratch, starting from, you know, if you have a meal, which is what I had, meal in my home, a small thing on the counter. And when we put in the show notes, we'll include all the links to your things. And also, there's a lady here in Lubbock that's great about, she shows people how to, you know, cook things, all kinds of different things with fresh ground grains. And so if you don't have a meal, you can pick up, you guys do more than sorghum at Revival Meal?
Yes.
So yeah, you can pick all of this stone ground up. You do not have to have a meal to do it, but you can follow Michaela Grapes, her name, and we'll put her in there too so that people will have some great ideas about what to do with all of the flour. I guess, would you call it flour? Do you call it sorghum flour?
Yep.
Yep. Okay. So with the flour that you pick up from Revival Meal. Ethan, thank you so much. This has been so fun and so educational.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. And we are constantly providing different varieties. In fact, just hopefully going to be picking up a variety of wheat tomorrow called, Bentley. Bentley, coming out of Plainview from Frontier Market.
I love it.
So those producers. So
we know those
bringing
guys.
That one into the mill. And we're going to be taking a trip over to our friends in Colorado to try to bring up some of the ancients here pretty soon. So,
oh my goodness.
Anyways,
that looks so exciting. Thank you. And thanks, friends, for listening to this episode of Conservation Stories. I am going to mention today that it would be really helpful if you would take the time to review the podcast. So you can just click on the little stars and tell the world that you like us and share. So it is really actually a way for you to think of donating to the work that is being done here at Sarah. It's a free thing that you can do, and it helps us out so much. So please review us and rate us and share us, and we look forward to seeing you or being with you next time on Conservation Stories.